It's the worst, it's the best, it's a dream, it's a mess. Their potential surprising, their fear.
Good afternoon and welcome to the new Dairy Show on WFVR-LP. My name is Alyssa Hartman, excited to be here on this somewhat gloomy afternoon. Let's get started by thanking our underwriters for the show. We've got Arby's Deli here in South Royalton. I bought a not winning lottery ticket from there a couple weeks ago, which was disappointing. Mountain Folk, which puts on a concert series in Tunbridge. Their next show is coming up in February 2019. Luna Blue Farm, growing lots of delicious veggies and providing some eggs for folks in the area. And Integrity Energy Solar Professionals. I believe they're in East Randolph. Okay, we have a fun guest here today with us, which we are excited for. But Steve, are you online? Are you here?
Here I am. Thank you very much, Alyssa. And thanks to all who are listening. I really appreciate it.
Yes, thanks, everyone. And we are going to have a fun show today because we are talking with Michael Colby from Regeneration Vermont. He is a journalist, and I imagine lots of other things he might use to identify himself as well. So hi, Michael. Thanks so much for being here today.
It's great to be here.
Thanks for coming all the way over. Where do you live in Burlington?
No, I live in Walden, up in the Northeast Kingdom.
Okay. How far of a drive was it for you?
Oh, it was about a little over an hour.
Okay.
Yep.
Any leaves up there still to peep?
No, it's stick season.
They're done.
Yeah.
Okay.
Well, I mean, some of the poplars still have some kicking around, but...
Not as nice of a drive as it was a month ago.
Not at all. Say. But it's always good to be down here.
Yeah. Well, thank you for coming. Can you tell us a little bit about Regeneration Vermont and what you do?
Well, we're a nonprofit. We were founded 3 years ago with the original purpose of kind of doing deep dives into the state of Vermont agriculture. And, of course, that means primarily the dairy industry. And so we've been doing a series of exposés on various aspects of the dairy industry, pointing out the problems, pointing out the tragedies, and also trying to put forward a vision, which is in the name, the regenerative part of our name, putting out a vision for what's going to replace this dinosaur of a dairy model that is really bringing not just the state, but the nation down in terms of dairy processing and production. So it's 3 years. We've published exposés on everything from GMOs to pesticides to antibiotics to the migrant labor issue, water quality, regulatory malfeasance, animal welfare, really the whole, what we call the 8-count dairy indictment. But again, we don't want to just be negative about all the problems in dairy, but we also want to, again, put together put out a vision for people to aspire to come out of the ashes of this Phoenix moment and rebuild Vermont agriculture within an image that we can be proud of and that is truly sustainable, because that's clearly not the case now. So
yeah,
and you can get our material. regenerationvermont.org is a website where you can get all the essays, all the research, all the reports, all the updates that we have.
Great. That's such important work, and I'm so glad that you are doing it. Thank you for doing it. So I think maybe one of your most recent publications was, I think, 2 weeks ago now in Vermont Digger about the use of antibiotics within the dairy industry. Is that right?
That's correct. That's the latest.
Okay. And what did you find out in that research and writing?
Well,
I know the answer. Maybe not everyone.
I found out a lot. That was just part one. That was kind of just a summary of kind of what we found after. It's probably been over 18 months of records requests and getting data from the agency, requesting it, fighting for it, trying to get the fees reduced for it, and then analyzing it. But in a nutshell, what we found, and we can get into the specifics, is that the regulation of antibiotic use on the farm in Vermont is very poor and negligent, I would say. It actually was part of the headline. It's basically a look away mentality from the Agency of Agriculture, which is the agency required to oversee the regulations put out by the Food and Drug Administration about antibiotic use on the farm. They're kind of the end of the line, the cops, more or less, to make sure that all the rules and regulations are being followed. So we found huge holes in the regulations themselves. A lot of disinformation about antibiotics in the dairy supply. For example, the big language within the industry is there are no antibiotics in the dairy supply. And that's problematic, because you have to understand that the testing is all based on tolerance levels, acceptable risk, how much can be in the dairy supply of a whole range of antibiotics. This is just the legal ones. You know, there's a whole aspect of this issue of the non-approved antibiotics that are being used, and we know they're being used because they're being found mostly in the cows that are being turned into meat, mm-hmm. In slaughter facilities. But we just found huge loopholes. We found an agency in the ag agencies, which we found in other areas when it comes to pesticide regulations, water quality enforcement. They have a really conflicted role in that they are there to promote agriculture in Vermont, as well as regulate and police. And it's two roles that are next to impossible to accomplish, giving justice to both. And issue after issue, it's their cheerleading function that is clearly trumping their enforcement. They look the other way and keep cheering, go Vermont Dairy, go Vermont Dairy. They look the other way on the antibiotics violations. They look the other way on the water quality violations. And the result at the end is the state of what we have in the dairy industry in Vermont.
If I can interrupt, let me just bring in a third function of the Vermont Agency of Agriculture. And I think this is the predominant one that drives their viewpoint and the way they handle the dairy industry in Vermont, and that is to ensure that the region's dairy processors and dairy food manufacturers have a continuous and cheap supply of commodity-grade manufacturing quality milk available for those highly profitable firms to continue to generate their fortunes with, while they continue to put tremendous economic pressure on the dairy farmers that produce the milk. The disparity between how the profits of the dairy industry are distributed between the manufacturers and the processors and the dairy farmers themselves is nothing short of obscene. And in my opinion, the Agency of Agriculture sees that as their number one function, is to make sure that there's plenty of cheap milk for companies like Ben & Jerry's, Stonyfield Yogurt, Hood, the old Gorelick.
Cabot,
Agamart, yeah, thank you very much. How could I forget? So anyway, I agree completely with you. And I also will say that this is just a tip of the iceberg of what the Vermont Agency of Agriculture, or Farm Agency of Farms and Food and Markets, is overlooking. There's a rampant disease that's infecting the dairy herd industry in Vermont, called BLV or the bovine leucosis virus, which has Center for Disease Control, the CDC, has come up with an almost sure link between that virus in the milk of cows, creating an environment for the development of cancer in humans, specifically types of breast cancer. And even though statutorily the Vermont Agency of Agriculture is supposed to prohibit and fight and eliminate any contagious diseases within Vermont's dairy herd, they are completely ignoring this. They're completely ignoring the prevalence of yonis, and even though that's a reportable disease. And why are they not addressing those or tackling those? It's because they're concerned that efforts to fight it may increase the price of milk for the processors and the dairy food manufacturers, and may cause a public scare in regard to the health and safety of Vermont's milk supplies. So I couldn't be in agreement more. I just think that it's a sad situation. I've been involved in this industry for 50 years, and I. Michael, I was astounded to read your article in Vermont Digger, and I thank you for it. And as a result, I contacted the Vermont Agency of Agriculture and asked them what the allowable limits were for milk. And I had to inquire with several people and go on down the line. But finally, they sent me back the standards, and I was a director of a dairy co-op, and as far as I knew, there were no antibiotics in the milk supply. That if we found a hot load, it was dumped, we'd test every producer, or if a producer asked us to test, we'd run a charm test or another test for antibiotics. And I was always under the impression that no milk had any antibiotics in it slipped through the cracks and went into public distribution. And you've opened my eyes to something which I think is just completely unacceptable and should be changed immediately. There should not be any antibiotics, any level of antibiotics in the milk supply in this, in Vermont and in the country. And I admire the, and thank you for the work you're doing to point this out.
I appreciate that. It was quite a bit of work trying to get that data from them. And there were some real eye-openers in the data. One we can talk about, which was in the article. We filed to get all of the antibiotic violation records from 2010 to present from the Vermont Agency of Agriculture. It cost us hundreds of dollars and months of back and forth and redactions and them trying to not give it to us. But anyway, eventually we got it, and it's astounding. What we found, one of the things we found is what they call routine positives, which I described in my article. And we were confused by that language. And what a routine positive is that if one individual, see, these farm trucks go out on several of the smaller farms that still exist, the farm truck can go to three or four farms and on in a route. And what the routine positives are is when one farm is picked up, and they have a hot load, a load that has higher than acceptable levels of antibiotics in it. But they also have to give the trucker a sample of that milk. But then the trucker takes that sample, puts it in the truck, goes to the next farm, picks up a load, goes to the next farm, picks up a load. When they bring this load to the processing plant, the whole load is tested there. If it's if it comes in below the acceptable amount of residues at that at the plant, it's processed, it's turned into product, and we consume it. After that, those little individual samples that each farm has to give, that's being analyzed at these processing facilities for butter, fat, for other things they want to test for. That's where they're finding these, what they call the routine positives. They found that that milk from that farm was in violation, but it's already been processed. As long as it was blended with the other farms to get below those acceptable levels and sent to the food supply. And that it was outrageous and actually very frightening to us. And there are, I mean, there's not like a lot of these cases, but there are on average several a year in the state. And then we also look further with on-site farm visits. And you mentioned the Charm Corporation, that's the testing agency basically. And they sell these little kits to farmers that, you know, I've interviewed with them, the corporation people, the testing people, and it's a game. The farmers are testing to make sure that they come within those levels. They know if they're using antibiotics, they've got to test, they've got to blend. We've got hideous stories from farm workers about some of the tricks they pull to get them down, some additives they put in the tanker to get the levels below so they can get that load for sale. Just loophole after problem after problem. And let's go back to, why are we using all these antibiotics? Because of the way we're housing and treating these animals. It's a concentrated animal feeding operation. It's confinement. It's filth. It is laden with pathogens and disease-causing, you name it, everywhere. And so in order to keep this game going, they have to be using enormous amounts of antibiotics, particularly in the dry-off period, routinely, to be able to keep these cows. I mean, look at these vets refer to these animals as, what do they call them? Nutrient superhighways. I mean, the goal is to just cram them with food to maximize production, keep the drugs in them to keep them upright long enough, which the life expectancy is dropping, and then ship them off to meat and just keep this cycle going. And it's just hideous on every level.
A couple questions for you in that.
Yes.
So how or what is the prime method used to administer antibiotics in a dairy farm? Is it in the feed or is it injectables?
Mostly injectables.
Okay.
Yes.
Interesting. And then, Steve, we were talking earlier today about this relationship with antibiotics in the drying off period. And you have had a vet who told you to stop doing this, right? This practice. However, we've seen conflicting information in places like Hordes Dairymen.
Yeah, I had it when I was had at my farm over in Shoreham, and even here, I was lucky to have a couple of good vets. And when I was in Shoreham, I did initially, upon the encouragement of the whole dairy industry, dry treat my cows, and I treated them with a dry treatment called, I think it was called Orbidin, and supposedly it had no withhold. You could begin to ship the milk as soon as as the cow cleared up of colostrum and you were getting milk. I don't know if that were the case or not. All I know is that that's what I read on the label and that's what I did. And and then I was talking to my vet about dry treating, and I was questioning the wisdom of it, and he said, yeah, don't dry treat. Anytime you fool with a cow's udder, you're creating an opportunity to put bacteria up her teat canal and have it start an infection. And it was an unusual vet. But I just read a thing in Hordes magazine where they came out with an editorial that recommended that all dairy farmers blanket dry treat their cows. They don't even select the ones that have the high somatic cell count, that you just automatically dry treat every one of your cows. And first of all, I think that that's just a terrible management advice. And number two, it's unnecessary. And number three, it does create an unfortunate opportunity for antibiotics to get into the, because you're always under pressure to ship milk from a fresh cow as soon as you possibly can. I mean, even waiting for her to clear up, for the colostrum to clear up so you've got good milk is painful, because you're having to discard the first two or three or four milkings until you're sure you have good white milk there. So anyway, I gave up on dry treating, and I've never operated a CAFO. I've never operated a confinement feeding operation. I've always grazed my cows, always had them out on pasture. The last 12 years I milked cows, I didn't have one case of mastitis, because I kept them clean and I kept their environment clean, and they were out on pasture and they just didn't need it. And so that's anyway, I won't dry treat, and I don't see if you can keep your cows clean and keep their environment clean, you shouldn't have to.
Yeah.
Which is the fundamental issue with CAFOs, right? Is that is not the system that they've set up to have cows in clean conditions with enough space. It's not,
that's really
not
controversial, because there are big farms where there are clean cows.
Yeah.
I mean, I can't just say that but there certainly are big farms where the cow, and there are small farms, as you just pointed out.
Yes, I did. We talked about that earlier today.
Yeah. So it's just a matter of management. But certainly, if you don't let your cows outside and they never have a chance to enjoy sunshine and green grass, and they're standing in manure on concrete all day, they're going to have foot problems, leg problems, and they're probably going to have a higher incidence of mastitis than a cow that has the opportunity to get outside and enjoy a little walking time on grass and the sunshine.
Mm-hmm. Before being shipped off for hamburger. Now, by average of before the age of six.
I heard the average lifespan of a cow on a commercial dairy is 4.5 years old.
Is it down to 4.5
now? That's what I've heard as well.
Wow.
That gives you, and it takes 2 years to get that heifer milking.
Yeah.
So that gives you less than 2 years to recover the return on your investment in her, which is often $2,000 plus. And
yeah,
if you're selling milk at a loss of $5 a hundredweight consistently, you never regain.
Yeah.
You never recover your investment. It's just a sad situation.
Yeah.
What were the age of cows that you dealt with in the past, Steve, on dairy farms? What do you think is like a reasonable age of a cow before it ships? 12?
Well, the oldest cow I milked, I think, was 18.
Okay.
If you can get your cows, if you can double your cow's productive life to 6.5 or 7 years, you've doubled your opportunity to recover your investment. Your costs are just so much lower. So it just doesn't make sense to burn them out. But the problem is that here's the terminology they use, which is you want to maximize the genetic potential for your cow to produce milk. And that means you feed them a lot of protein, a lot of soluble fiber, and you're just pushing them to the point where they just couldn't make another drop of milk. And feeding them high levels of concentrates, you're feeding them ground up candy bars, you're feeding them whatever, you know, lots of soy. I fed my cows a little grain, but mostly hay and pasture, and I fed to keep them alive and keep them healthy and for body condition. But unfortunately, these days, with the economic pressures that most farmers are under, and the way they're advised by the Agency of Agriculture and Cornell and UVM and all these nutritionists that come in. I mean, I had a nutritionist tell me never to let my cows out, keep them inside where I could control the level of feed and maximize their production. I thought he was crazy. And I've had people tell me not to give my cows shade when they're on pasture because you want them out working in the, and cows need shade. So it's just all based towards burning the cows out early and getting them to produce as much milk as they possibly can in the first couple of years of their life.
Thinking of them more as a cog, maybe, than a cow. Like a little piece that moves through the machine.
And the production averages from your average cow have just skyrocketed. I think in the 70s it was around 7,000 pounds a year per cow. And I think the last time I checked, it was up a couple of years ago, it was up to 22,000 pounds a cow. I think that was 2016. So that's per cow per year. From the 1970s to today, that kind of dramatic increase per cow is, of course, making them sick.
Yeah.
You were just pushing and pushing and pushing and pushing them.
So in terms of this antibiotic issue, it seems like first step in improving this is getting accurate data.
We need data. And that was the other part that was, I'm sorry to cut you off.
No, please.
It was really astounding to us because we also looked at, you know, if you look at World Health Organization, the CDC, I mean, every AMA, every major health organization has got the sirens and the red lights on about antibiotic resistance issues. Last year, it cost 23,000 U.S. citizens their lives. Over 2 million people were sickened by coming in contact with bacteria that were antibiotic resistant. And the first thing they say to do, to address this problem is try to reduce use. That's especially uses for preventive measures, especially uses for, you know, 80% of the U.S. antibiotic usage total is done on farm. So that's where we need to focus. That's where we need to have a plan. If you want to reduce antibiotic use in society, you have to have a plan at the farm level.
Mm-hmm.
So the first thing we did was ask the agency, okay, first of all, could you give us data on how much is being used in the state? They don't keep track of that. You go to the federal level, FDA. Could we get how much is being used nationwide on the farm level? They don't even have that. The pharmaceutical industry has got our agencies, particularly at the federal level, I mean, too scared to even ask for usage figures. So the FDA, when they give usage figures and trends, they're basing it on financial data, on sales data that they can kind of extract from their, you know, annual reports and whatever.
And it's clear even from that information that on-farm use is the largest use of antibiotics in the
U.S. Yeah. In terms of the 80%.
Who knows how staggering that number must actually be if we had real data instead of just financial data.
Exactly. And if you have a plan to address something as serious as the antibiotic resistance issue, the first place to start is, what's the baseline?
Yeah.
Where are we at? How much are we using? So the state has no idea. They don't keep track. And then we said, well, what's your plan then for reduction? We had to file this in a Freedom of Information request, a series of questions to Dr. Kristen Haas, who is the state veterinarian, who very curiously has also the title of Director of Food Safety and Consumer Protection. It's a very odd combination of titles. And we asked her, what is the agency's plan for reducing on-farm use? Very simple answer for her, we have no plan. We have no goals. We have no plan. We're basically looking the other way. And she keeps going back and forth to, we encourage judicious use of antibiotics. That's our goal. That's our plan. So they have no data. They have no plan. And it's the Wild West on these big dairy farms. And again, you know, I have empathy for these dairy farmers. These are rough times. They're making no money. Their backs are against the wall. So many of them are like have inherited generations of this in their lifeblood. I've been involved in agriculture my entire life as well. I understand that yearning. You want to hang on for everything. And it's forcing them to make decisions which are hurting not only themselves, but their cows and their water supplies near them. And we're just trying to put a spotlight on it, trying to get people to understand that we're going down the wrong path. It's not the farmer's fault. It's the model that the farmers are being forced to participate in. And that's what we have to change. If we really had some democracy in our agricultural policy and it really reflected what we as Vermonters want to see on our farms, it would look a whole lot different. It would look a lot like we see it marketed on the side of the trucks, the Ben and Jerry's trucks and the Cabot trucks where cows are on grass. That's what it would look like. Unfortunately, it mostly looks like that in the marketing, not in the reality.
Yeah. A couple of things I want to catch on this topic before we move to something else. You pointed out both in the title of the state veterinarian. Can you say what is her title again?
She's the state veterinarian, and she's also the director of food safety and consumer protection.
Okay. And you also mentioned how the Agency of Agriculture has these kind of multi-sided responsibilities that are somewhat in conflict with one another.
Yeah.
And this is true also for the USDA. So this is an issue that goes up to the federal level. Yeah. They have a mandate to do different tasks that work against one another.
Absolutely.
And it's a very complicated part of the system. And I think there have been some folks who've suggested that the Department of Agriculture gets broken out into some of the subsets of what it does so that it isn't so much in conflict with itself, but that is a hard thing to do.
Absolutely. And on antibiotics, they have no business overseeing the antibiotics usage. It should be the health department for sure. And similar with water quality. I mean, that should be within the Agency of Natural Resources, in my opinion. And it begins at the top. I mean, this current secretary, Anson Tebbets, he comes from a public relations background, you know, and that's basically how he's running the agency, in my opinion. It's just one big public relations show, one big glossy news piece on how wonderful everything is. And I think it's a huge disservice to the realities. And until we get an ag agency in there who is truly going to have a vision for getting us out of the hole we're digging, we're just kind of stuck. And that's kind of the way it's been with these agency heads. They just get in there and rah-rah. Vermont farms are great. All Vermont farms are great. And keep charging over the cliff.
Just to be fair, Anson did come from a farm family, I think, in Cabot or Duxbury before he got into PR. But his most recent position was as, I think, news director for WCAX. And you can clearly see, at least on the Facebook page of the Agency of Agriculture, that it is all about PR and promoting Anson touring farms like a conquering hero and mm-hmm. and promoting giving the impression that everything is wonderful when, you know, farmers are going out of business and it's a terrible situation.
Yes, it is.
One other thing I wanted to mention around the antibiotic resistance issue. Several years ago, I guess about 5 years ago now, I worked on a campaign for Food and Water Watch around antibiotic resistance. I was in St. Louis, Missouri, encouraging the county council as well as the city board of aldermen to pass resolutions banning the subtherapeutic use of antibiotics on factory farms in the state of Missouri. And our talking points were very much around you do not have an issue with antibiotic resistance because of what you're eating. It's like a broader systems issue, and there's antibiotics in the manure, and it gets into the manure lagoon, and then a fly goes in the manure lagoon and flies the antibiotic resistance near you. So I think, and Food and Water Watch is an organization that generally I really like, and I think that just points to the degree of misinformation about the fact that there are antibiotics in our food. I think somehow, both in Vermont and nationally, that message has not been getting through, and probably purposefully, mm-hmm. because we don't want to think about our food having antibiotics in it. But mm-hmm. it does, clearly, from what you found.
I'm curious about your campaign. How did that turn out?
It didn't turn out well because I moved to St. Louis 5 days before Michael Brown was murdered. So that wasn't really a good conversation to be having at that time. Yeah. It was important that the Black Lives Matter movement have a lot of time in the state house at that point.
Yeah. So that was going to be a statewide initiative, or was it?
Food and Water Watch was working on passing 100 municipal resolutions and was trying to use that as a leverage point to bring it up to the state legislatures as well as the federal government.
Yeah.
I think they did pass more than 100 municipal resolutions. Actually, Burlington passed one, and I think Montpelier did as well.
Yeah, I think we need to, what we're going to be we're talking to legislators now is trying to at least force the state to start keeping track.
And like you said, the data is really the obvious first point to make a plan, an effective plan.
And then I think that'll also just continue the conversation, get people thinking about it, looking into it, and also educating everybody about the realities of these tolerance levels that that they're operating under. And I think we also I'm a consultant with the Organic Consumers Association. We're involved in a lawsuit against Ben & Jerry's for false advertising and consumer deception, based on the claims they make of their product versus the realities of how they farm. I think something similar, and we're talking with attorneys, something very similar of all these claims where they're saying there are no antibiotics in the dairy supply. They're antibiotic free. That's consumer deception.
Do they make that claim on their packaging?
Packaging is interesting, but certainly within the regulatory level, and I'm sure within their marketing that they're saying it. And I think that needs to be addressed because it's not true.
Absolutely. There's really a lot about that product that
we're also talking to labs to actually, we're going to start doing some testing of products as well, just like we tested Ben & Jerry's and found the glyphosate. I mean, it's not hard to do. There are labs out there using it like they are in these farms. You can find it in the products, even though they said it's not getting in the products. It's in the products. It's there. So let's just be honest about what the ramifications are of these kind of farming techniques.
Yeah. And I, one other question on all this, and correct me if I'm inaccurately capturing what this has been like for you, but it seems like in a lot of the reporting you've done, it has not been an easy task to get the information you need from the Agency of Agriculture. Is that true? On a variety of topics, it seems that's been the case.
Yeah, and I should say, I don't want to throw everyone there under the bus. There are some wonderful employees there. We're blessed in this state of having some really good public servants and very accessible. So I can pick up the phone and I do get in touch with them and they do respond, which I thank them for. I think it's very valuable. But there are times, too many in my opinion, where they do try to put up roadblocks. Nutrient management plans, for example. I mean, one of the big problems with water quality, they say the statewide data on water problems is about half of the problem is caused by industrial farm runoff. That's statewide. In the crisis areas, like up in Lake Carmi, their state data says that 85% of that problem is from agricultural runoff. So how do farms manage this runoff? Well, it's managed through a nutrient management plan that they're required to have, which basically lays out how many animals they have, how many nutrients they have to disperse, how many they're bringing in, exporting, everything. It's all in these plans. So we thought, let's see these plans, particularly for the big CAFOs. There are now 33, they call them large farm operations in the state. There are now 33 of them. That's up 20% in the last 4 years of the big farms. These are the farms with more than 700 cows. Some of them have thousands of cows, literally. So we said, let's start by asking for the nutrient management plans of each of these big farms and try to analyze it, study it, see if it's being followed, whatnot. They said, sure, we'll give you those. We would like $33,000 for them.
What?
$33,000.
How did they come up with that number? Just $1,000 per farm?
There was like research time and copying and, you know, and then the legislature, you know, they ran to their buddies in the legislature, Bobby Starr, among the top enablers in the Vermont legislature for, you know, look the other way and praise all things farming. He even tried to go so far as introduce legislation that would make it illegal to provide these to the public. When they got wind that we were poking around wanting these things, the first step was to try to charge us $33,000, which worked. We didn't have that. We weren't going to pay that. But then to make sure that just in case we came up with that money, Bobby Starr in the legislature introduced legislation, don't allow this to get out to the public. This is a plan of what they're doing with their manure, by and large. this isn't like a nuclear secret, some kind of...
But maybe it is.
Some. I mean, we're asking for how many cows, how much waste, where are you putting it? And there's also stuff in there about, you know, the soil samples they have to do and whatnot. So we want, if you want to understand the what's causing half of the water quality issues in this, problems in this state, wouldn't you want to start by looking there? And they put up a lot of roadblocks. In the end, we did end up negotiating with them, and we got one of the nutrient management plans from one of the farms.
One of the large farms.
One of the large farms. And we've been analyzing that. And much like with the antibiotics data, we've found, I'm not going to throw the farm under the bus here. We try not to name the specific farms because we do have a lot of respect for the stress and the struggles they're under. But these plans are full of holes, full of holes.
Do you think that they exist? Like, do you think there is a nutrient management plan for all 33 of those farms?
Oh, and without question, they have to. They have to file, and they're very extensive. That's part of to give them some slack. The 33,000 charge, I think each plan was, I forget, several hundred pages. So it was a significant amount. But they didn't tell us at the time until we got the one that they could just give it to us electronically. It's just email the file. They just try to
how they received it from the farm as well.
Exactly. But they do. Yeah. But are they following them? I mean, this specific farm, when we analyzed it, we found out that they had a satellite farm that was operational that the agency didn't even know about. It had more than 700 cows. The agency had no idea. They were building a manure pit, 7 million gallon manure pit on this satellite farm, and it was like football fields. I mean, they had these excavators, and it was giant. And so I said, that's interesting. Let me go back and file a Freedom of Information request from the Ag Agency and say, what's up with this pit? I'm not seeing it corresponding in their nutrient management plan. I'm not understanding what's going on here. And they said, we have no information of a pit being built there. And literally, if you stood there, how did you miss it? And they didn't file for any applications. They didn't file for any approval. The agency didn't even know they had these 700 plus cows being milked and milk was being shipped. They didn't know about the 7 million gallon manure pit. These are the kind of loopholes that you can drive a truck through. But instead, the agency went into like defensive mode and tried to shut us down from getting more information on this and tried to quickly cover up. In fact, the agency said when we informed them, the agency sent a letter to this farm and said, we want to come out and look. And the farm said, you're not welcome on our property. And then the agency sent another letter like, please, can we come on your property? And their lawyer said, no, can we pretty please come on? I mean, it was like this months of this back and forth of the agency just trying to get their feet on the ground. And finally, when they went there, they said, yes, this is a new pit. Yes, this is an operational farm. And yes, you need to fill out an LFO application for this farm. But they had no idea. They had no idea. But they have no, yeah, anyway. But the promotional side, they never miss a beat on that.
That story, that ended up in the media, didn't it? That
it did.
Yeah.
It did. I turned over all of my records and data to Mike Pulhamus at Vermont Digger.
Okay.
And he and actually we took him up and took him around the area. We showed him everything, and then he did a really great expose on that based on our data. Yeah.
Right. Doesn't Act 64 give the Ag Commissioner the right to enter into any dairy farm in the state? I thought that was that was considered to be a...
Absolutely.
Yeah.
So okay. Was the agency just trying to be polite?
I think the agency was doing what their fallback position is all the time, which is to protect the industry before they work for the betterment of the public. It's a sad commentary, but it's true time and time and time and time again. I mean, we've supplied. Yes, that is very true what you said, Steve. The Act 64 does give really broad and extreme powers to the secretary to come in and say this can't happen. And when we were exposing a lot of the Lake Carmi situation, we had people out with cameras, and you know, the easiest thing to do is to drive around Franklin County and find a water quality violation. I mean, it's just like it's shooting fish in a barrel. I mean, it's like cows standing in water, you know. I mean, it's just everywhere. It's the easiest thing. So we said, well, let's just start taking pictures and using the ag agency's online form for filing these complaints and showing the agency where the violations were. So we started doing that. And we probably filed, I don't know, half dozen, 10, and never heard a word back on any of them. Even when in public meetings we said, how about those pictures? How about that stuff we showed you? We've never heard back. And then they'd tell us in public meetings, well, we're going to get back to you. We're on that. Never heard a peep. Never heard a peep. So it's unfortunately looking the other way time and time and time again.
So this is a bit of a segue into the other topic I wanted to cover with you today, Michael. When I first met you, I met you at an event in, where was that?
Jeffersonville,
Vermont, that was organized by Rural Vermont, and it was a panel on pesticide use in the state.
Yes.
And you were part of the panel and had some interesting information to share on that topic. Kind of, I forget what this name of this committee is called. Remind me again.
The Pesticide Advisory Council.
And what is that?
It is a council established by statute by the state of Vermont with a charter to analyze pesticide usage data and reduce its use in the state of Vermont. That's its charter. It has a number of members, like the Ag Agency, I think, has two or three seats, the Health Agency, A&R might have a seat. There's a couple of public advocacy seats that also make up this board, and they meet I forget how often they meet, but say, you know, golf courses that want to use, get permits to spray, railroad right-of-ways, they oversee all of the permitting and regulation of
for any type of pesticide.
Exactly.
Use,
golf
not just
courses,
agricultural
farms. Exactly.
Okay.
Exactly.
And what year were they created?
Ah, boy, that's a good question. '90s, maybe '80s. I'm not sure specifically when what year.
Okay.
But what I spoke about in Jeffersonville was the difficulty of getting the state. The state is required again by statute every year to publish pesticide usage data. They stopped doing that in 2013. If you look on their website, that's the last year they've publicly publish their pesticide usage data. We've had to fight them to try to get subsequent years. We have gotten the data from 2014 to 2016, which they vouched for, which showed huge increases of pesticides, particularly with glyphosate. There's a huge increase in glyphosate. Reason for that was cover crops. They use it as a burn down in the spring. Farmers didn't want to deal with it. All these nuisance cover crops in their fields when they want to get to the corn. So they are approved to put glyphosate down to kill off the cover crop before they put the corn in, which spiked glyphosate use in 2016 by 120%.
Then you use the glyphosate after the corn is up.
Exactly. Exactly. Which is why it spiked 129%. So we found that and we publicized that. But the interesting thing was we went to the Pesticide Advisory Council meetings to ask them about this, to say, okay, we have this data. They looked at us and they said, we don't have that data. The Ag Agency hadn't supplied this committee with the usage data, and they still haven't published it. And so they're sitting there applying new uses and whatnot with absolutely no information or data. And we had it. So we emailed it to the committee because when the agency, they just gave it to us. They didn't publish it. We published it in VT Digger so that all of Vermont and the world could actually see it. But the worst part of this story is in the summer, we asked for the 2017 data. And they sent it to us, but the cover letter from Kerry Gaguerre at the Agency of Agriculture with the data said, here's the data. I'm paraphrasing. Here's the data. It's subject to change. We're not convinced about the validity of any of it, but here it is. I mean, which basically, as a researcher and a journalist, the data was worthless. I mean, pretty much.
You might as well not have it.
Yeah. And again, the statute says it's in the law of the state of Vermont that the Secretary of Agriculture shall provide and publish publicly this data every year. 2013, they've been thumbing their nose at the public. What are the ramifications? What are the penalties? What are the problems associated with this? Zero. Absolutely nothing. We've taken this to the state house. We've taken it to the governor's office. And I should point out, you asked who was on this committee. there are a lot of vacancies on this board. Two of the public advocates, they call it the public advocate seats for this board, are empty, and they have been empty for years. They don't even fill them. The seat dedicated to the medical school at UVM is empty. It might be nice to have someone from the medical school in there looking at this data and giving a little input when we're approving hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of thousands of pounds of toxic chemicals throughout our state via farm, golf course, right of way, utility, et cetera, et cetera. But by and large, our overall picture of looking at the usage data found that despite what we were told with the transfer to GMO crops that we'd have less pesticides, the data showed absolutely the opposite, which, of course, we were predicting all along.
And you can link that directly to the dairy industry.
Absolutely. The dairy industry is growing. I think the last figures I saw was around 90, 91,000 acres of GMO corn in the state every year. And that's where the primary the data that they do send out, it actually breaks it down. We can see exactly what's being used on corn crops in the state of Vermont. And that data since, I'm trying to remember the years now, when it ballooned, probably 2006 or 8 or so. I forget when it jumped to pretty much all corn, field corn corn in the state of Vermont grown is GMO now. I think it's 98%, something to that effect. So yeah, you track that usage and the corn pesticide usage, and it's, yeah, the more GMO crops, the more pesticides, the more fertilizers.
Yeah. Great.
Not what we're promising.
I farmed before Roundup Ready corn was available, and you didn't grow corn, basically, because it was just so labor-intensive to cultivate. And it was with the introduction of Roundup Ready corn that the corn production has just exploded. You see it now up and down Route 14 here in Vermont, little teeny fields that would never have been planted. The corn were always hayed with perennials now are in corn. And you can see that it's been sprayed with glyphosate. One of the interesting things what I find personally frustrating is, because I pay attention to these discussions, is that no one seems to have come out with any definitive statement about whether or not glyphosate or Roundup has been proven to be a carcinogenic. And I just wish we could get a definitive word on that, because it when I discuss it with people, it's, you know, I always have to fall back and say, well, they suspect that it's carcinogenic, but I've never really come across any definitive statement, yes, it is, or no, it's not.
The most definitive would be from the World Health Organization, the IARC, which called it a probable carcinogen. I think California followed up with that kind of language. But yeah, in terms of, I mean, they're always winning, the people that purveyors of these toxins, because cancer doesn't leave a calling card. You know, if you went to the hospital and said you have cancer and look at here, this was from, we don't have that.
And when you're registering a pesticide, it's incumbent upon the registrant to provide the types of studies that would be asked for in terms of health impacts like this. And so it's quite easy to make those look the way you might want them to look.
Yes.
But Monsanto did just lose a fairly massive case that was brought to them by a farmer.
The price was brought down. The payment was brought down.
$73 million, I think.
Well, $200 million, I believe. Because he actually won $289 million total, and I think they brought it down to 39 or 50. Yeah,
the last I read it was around $73 million.
Oh, was it?
Yeah. Which, good. Sounds reasonable to me.
Absolutely. Just in time for Bayer to buy him out and watch their stock tumble. But there's going to be a lot. There are a lot more lawsuits coming out, and I think there's going to be glyphosate is going to be a Achilles heel for this industry.
The pesticide council that you were talking about, are there meetings open to the public?
Yes.
Okay.
Yes, and they're held at the Vermont Life. There's a state kind of facility up there, up at the Vermont Life headquarters in Montpelier. But yes, they're usually not too many people, the public there, probably three other people sitting there while the advisory council looks over and approves pesticide usage.
From the data you saw from 2013, was it sorted by use or could you sort it by use? Do you know what percentage approximately is agricultural? It's fine if you don't. That was several years ago.
I'm trying to think. Just the corn. Yeah, I don't want to. I don't want to make something off the top.
Do you recall if it was the largest use?
Yes.
Okay, it was.
I might actually have it here. I want to say the corn alone was around a couple hundred thousand pounds, and I think the overall in the state was around 800,000. But again, I should if you go to our site, regenerationvermont.org, and Google in the pesticide usage, you can see all the – we actually have all the raw data up there. So look at that more than what you just
listened
to out of my mouth.
Everyone should check out Regeneration Vermont online after this conversation. Well, we have just a couple minutes left. Steve, any other pressing questions?
Well, I would just like to say that the whole idea of the blended supply of milk when a dairy, when a tanker truck stops at three or four farms, it not only impacts and dilutes any potential antibiotic contamination, it also, the same thing happens with high somatic cell counts, which is white, which is basically pus in milk, and with high bacteria counts. If the truckload arrives at the plant and the bacteria levels and the somatic cell levels are okay, then the milk will be processed regardless of the quality of the milk that comes from the individual farms. And, you know, back in the 1990s, we developed a company that prohibited that. Basically, we would test every farm every time for somatic cell, for antibiotics, bacteria, total bacteria counts, and they had to, all the farms had to stay under a certain limit in order for that, for us to be able to take the milk and process it and sell it under our brand. And the Agency of Agriculture, it was actually the Department of Agriculture at the time, and the commissioner fought aggressively to put us out of business because they did not want that. We also said we wouldn't take milk from farms that were giving their cows BST at the time, which was a hormone to stimulate milk production. So, I mean, I could sit here for another 2 hours and go over and talk about how it's, and the unfortunate thing is that when you start talking about these things, people think, oh, you're picking on the poor farmers. I was a farmer for 50 years. I'm not picking on farmers. I understand it. I lived it. I've milked cows. It's not the farmer's fault. It's the industry's fault. It's the USDA. It's Cornell. It's UVM. Everybody that's just tried to exploit the farmers through the years so that Ben and Jerry's and these other big corporations could make fortunes and make all these profits and cut the farmers out. So anyway, that's my opinion.
And we'll go out on that opinion.
And it's one I agree with. So.
Yeah, me too. All right. Thanks to Arby's Deli, Mountain Folk, Luna Blue Farm, and Integrity Energy Solar Professionals for underwriting the show. And please shoot us a note if you would like to provide any feedback at thenewdairyshow@gmail.com. I apologize to our caller today, and I swear I will learn how to answer the phone soon. And we are going to go out on a request of Steve's from a few weeks ago that I managed to not forget about. So here is Joni Mitchell with Raised on Robbery.
He was sitting in the lounge of the Empire Hotel. He was drinking for diversion. He was thinking for himself. A little money riding on the maple leaves. Along comes a lady in lacy sleeves.